Several California men are now facing prosecution in a new effort to crack down on sex tourism across the border. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. FBI investigators in San Diego say the sex crimes are taking place in Tijuana and other locations overseas. They're making use of a recent law against traveling with the intent of having sex with a minor. Evidence includes a series of text messages between the men and a Tijuana sex broker that refer to girls and boys for sale, using terms like brand new and recently stolen. Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS has more with San Diego Union-Tribune reporter Christina Davis, who's following the cases. We warn you, the interview is disturbing and not suitable for young children.
Has Tijuana been a frequent haunt of pedophiles from the U.S., or is this unusual?
Unfortunately, this kind of activity is nothing new. If you talk to Marisa Ugarte, she is one of the biggest victim advocates here in San Diego against this kind of activity. And she's been doing this kind of work against child sex trafficking down in Tijuana for decades. You know, it's been talked about here and there. There have been orphanages and homes and services for these children. But these recent cases just show that it's still a big problem down there. It hasn't gone away.
How young are the children being bought and sold?
The specific cases that I looked up, the men were specifically requesting as young as 8 years old. And these were just the very recent cases. They were kind of focusing in this age range of around like 8 to 12. But we've seen other cases where, I mean, unfortunately, I've seen, newborns and infants. And there was a seminary student from the Midwest a few years ago who was coming down to Tijuana with the intent to have sex with, he was requesting infant girls, so all ages.
One of the text messages in your story talks about a young girl, quote, recently stolen. Do we know where these kids are being trafficked from?
All over the country and even up from Central and South America. You can look at the immigration patterns and there's so many people and unaccompanied minors traveling up from those areas through Mexico. They could be targets of this kind of industry. There are certain towns in central Mexico that are known to be actual recruiting hubs of sex traffickers and of children. They can be orphans in Tijuana. They can be the children of other sex workers. I mean, it really runs the gamut. But talking to some of the experts, it seems like most of these children are brought up kind of from other parts of the country. They're not from Tijuana necessarily.
You mentioned two men from California who've recently been arrested for allegedly trying to arrange sex with underage kids in Mexico. Are they awaiting trial, and how much time could they face if convicted?
So, yes, both of them were pretty recently arrested, so their cases are very new in the process. At this stage, they've basically been arraigned, and I would imagine right now they're starting to get discovery. Their lawyers are starting to get discovery from the prosecution of kind of what they're up against. If they're going to go to trial, I mean, that could be another year or two out. These cases do take quite a while in federal court. If they're being charged under the PROTECT Act, they can be sentenced up to 30 years in prison for just the charge of traveling with the intent to have sex with a minor. They don't even have to prove that they actually had sex. It's only intent, and they can get up to 30 years.
Tell us a little bit more about the PROTECT Act. I said it's recently a recent law, but actually it's been on the books for quite some time now.
That's right. So this is not the first law to address this kind of activity. I think there was one back in 93 or 94 that was passed, but apparently it wasn't as strong, and I think there may be some loopholes in it. And the reality, too, is that the federal government just wasn't prosecuting very many people under the law. And then 2004 came along and they wrapped up this kind of sex tourism type law in the PROTECT Act. It's a very large act that deals with a lot of kind of child protections and child abuse, that kind of thing.
That was Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS speaking with San Diego Union-Tribune reporter Christina Davis. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested nearly 500 people in 4 days in immigration raids last month alone. While none happened in Texas, the raids and recent anti-sanctuary city legislation have the estimated 1.6 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. worried, so much so that parents are having what's being called the talk with their children about the possibility of arrest and deportation. KUT's Joy Diaz has more.
The Esquivel family is gathered in a circle at their home.
My name's Yesenia Esquivel.
Mi nombre es José Tomás Esquivel.
My name is Betsaida Esquivel.
Y por allá, Yesenia Esquivel.
Okay. In case you're confused, this is a mom and a dad and their two teenage girls. Mom and oldest daughter share the same name, Yesenia.
¿Quién nació en Estados Unidos?
I asked the family about their immigration status.
I was born here in Austin, Texas.
Like thousands of Texas families, this is a mixed status family. The girls are American, their parents are from Mexico, they've been living in Austin for 20 years, undocumented. Yesenia, the mom, faces her namesake daughter, her oldest, and tells her, if we get deported, you guys are staying put.
I want you to cancel every service, everything, get rid of every expense, just keep the lights on in the house, and keep a phone for you and your sister.
Keep the house. Find a way to pay the mortgage, she says. Dad chimes in. Find a way to stay in school, too, he tells both girls.
Ever since you two were little girls, you've always enjoyed school. You are educated girls. Keep up with school, even if we're gone, because that's something I was never able to do. Stay in school.
If I were to leave, I've talked to some friends and we have a plan and they've agreed to help come up with your first mortgage payment. I can set you up that way. Our friends will set you on the right path, but this is so tough. You may seem old enough, but we've never been apart. This is so hard. Anyway, that's the plan.
The youngest daughter, 15-year-old Betsaida, is beside herself. Her fisted hands are on her lap.
This, like, it makes me not cry from sadness. It just makes me cry from, like, angriness.
19-year-old Yesenia tries to take it all in.
Hearing my parents tell me, like, oh, if this were to happen, like, you would take care of your sister, have custody of her. Like, knowing that all of this is possible, it's kind of terrifying.
Their father, Tomás, is frustrated. And some of his frustration is aimed at Texas Governor Greg Abbott.
En algún tiempo yo llegué a hacerles de comer, porque él iba a comer donde yo trabajo.
I've cooked for him, you know. He's like eating at the restaurant where I work. And before he was governor, when he was AG, we thought he was going to be a good governor. He seemed to love Hispanics, and he truly had the Latino vote. How things have changed. Why did he change? I challenge him to visit construction sites and restaurants. Who are the people who work the hardest and make the least? We only come here to work. Stop those laws. And get to know me.
Yesenia asks her husband, isn't the governor's daughter the same age as ours? Yes. Audrey Abbott is only months older than the Esquivel's oldest daughter.
I'd like to touch his heart. You are a fighter, governor. You fought to be where you are. You fight for your family. I'm a fighter, too, doing the same things as you.
Daughter Yesenia fears no one will listen to what her parents are saying. And she wonders,
how do you love a country that you love and you know, but the country's not loving you back?
If this were their last day together, Tomás and Yesenia want the girls to know all they mean to them.
I believe you two are the greatest gift to me in my life.
My greatest privilege is to be your mother, and I thank God to have had you.
The family embraces.
Oh, I don't want to cry.
Today, they are together. Tomorrow, who knows? Will Yesenia get the master's in education she dreams of? Will Betsaida become the OBGYN she wants to be? The most pressing question is, will their parents be deported? Because so many things depend on the answer.
I'm Joy Diaz.
Construction crews are erecting 8 looming prototypes of President Trump's border wall in a remote section of the San Diego borderlands. 4 are solid concrete, 4 are made of steel and concrete, 1 is topped with spikes. They all approach 30 feet in height. Customs and Border Protection is paying $20 million to 6 construction companies from Mississippi, Maryland, Alabama, Arizona, and Texas. Crews in white hard hats operating cranes and forklifts are expected to complete the models by the end of the month. John Burnett has details.
We're actually at the prototype site, San Diego sector, where 8 of the prototypes are being built.
That's Border Patrol Agent Eduardo Olmos of the San Diego sector.
Once these are built, they're going to be evaluated for different characteristics like anti-climbing, anti-breaching, anti-scaling, anti-digging, anti-tunneling. Also, they have to be aesthetically pleasing.
The prototypes have all the appeal of blast walls. Some models are solid reinforced concrete. Others incorporate vertical steel posts. On the U.S. side, no one is allowed anywhere near the wall prototypes because of security precautions. To see what people think about them, I crossed the border at the Otay Mesa Port of Entry and worked my way over to the Los Torres neighborhood of Tijuana. There's a ramshackle recycling business here in Mexico that looks directly onto the soaring concrete slabs. Jose Avila Rodriguez is pulling wires out of the dashboard of a wrecked truck. From the sides of the wall they're building, they don't even want the wind to blow from there to over here, he says ruefully. His granddaughter Melanie plays with puppies in the dusty street. Her grandmother Juana fills a bag with plastic bottles and considers Trump's border wall. I don't think the new wall will deter people, she says. How many years have they been crossing to the other side? Border Patrol officials in San Diego say they need some kind of new obstacle. Illegal crossers have cut 1,700 holes in the existing steel mesh fencing in the past 3 years. Just in the past 3 weeks, a half dozen Mexican men have been nabbed in the construction zone while the prototypes were going up. Roy Villarreal is the chief patrol agent here.
What we want is something that is better, that it's, again, impenetrable, unscalable, and not capable of being dug under very quickly.
6 construction companies that won a nationwide competition to design and build the prototypes have until the end of this month to finish the 8 mock-ups. I ask Villarreal, after his agency selects its favorite designs, does he believe these giant barriers will actually go up along the 2,000-mile frontier? He doesn't want to be pinned down.
These prototypes are going to influence the next evolution of our border infrastructure. So it very well may not be what you witnessed this morning.
Border Patrol officials are not waiting for a new wall design. The chief in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas told me he's planning to build 60 new miles of barriers, if Congress funds it. But he'll use what's there now, rust-colored steel columns that rise no higher than 18 feet. The administration has asked Congress for $1.6 billion for the first segments of the president's border wall. But it faces a number of obstacles. It's opposed by congressional Democrats, as well as most of California's and San Diego's leadership. And lawmakers in Washington are being hit with billions in unforeseen spending for hurricane damages from Texas to Puerto Rico. Doris Meisner, a former immigration commissioner and now a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, thinks prospects for funding the wall look dim.
The real issue with building a wall is what the Congress does, not what the contractors do. And the price tag on this is enormous.
The Border Patrol expected the prototypes to spark big protests. But since construction began, there have been no demonstrations.
We knew that this was political theater and that we weren't going to respond. This is much to do about nothing.
That's Christian Ramirez, director of the Southern Border Communities Coalition in San Diego, which has organized local rallies against Trump's immigration policies, but not this time.
John's story originally aired on Morning Edition on NPR on October 19th. Coming up next on Fronteras, a long-standing Mexican tradition, Día de los Muertos, celebrating the dead through art.
As long as we say their name, as long as we keep them in our hearts, as long as we celebrate their life, they are alive.
We'll explore that story and generating business on the Navajo Nation when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Fossil fuel companies are offering jobs in rural New Mexico, but the industry uses up resources and creates pollution. Some folks in these regions say the trade-off isn't fair. One organization is working on the Navajo Nation to stabilize the boom and bust economy of extraction by boosting local entrepreneurs and small business. Marissa DeMarco of KUNM has the story.
When you're standing on the North Loop family farm, you can see for miles. There are not many other people or houses nearby, just the mountain in the distance.
These are sweet corn here, heirloom sweet corn, and they were really delicious.
Stacy Jensen is the manager of the nonprofit farm. 30 or more families around here farm cooperatively and bring home fresh food to their families. Most of the crops have already been harvested.
You should see it. It's quite a sight, you know, to see all the children and the folks out in the fields on weekends or in the evenings when it cools off.
Small businesses like this farm could help the struggling economy on the Navajo Nation, one that rises and falls with the ups and downs of the fossil fuel industry.
I think this farm can be duplicated elsewhere, but again, it depends. You got to have water, you got to have land, okay, and then you got to have the community to really make this thing grow.
Jensen's been able to hire local people to work on the farm, and he'd like to hire a lot more in the years to come. But starting any business out here can be hard, he says, because on some parts of the Navajo Nation, they're missing the basics: internet access, water, sewer, or electricity.
Well, you know, as you can tell, you know, we often do with little or no resources out here, but we do a lot.
No one's really sure how many small businesses there are here, because people across the region do business without registering. It could take years for Navajo entrepreneurs to get access to property on the reservation. Leasing and building involve jumping over many U.S. government hurdles, and the process is expensive. Navajo Nation President Russell Begay says all of that started changing as of April 1st this year, when the nation took control of leasing and zoning their lands.
We're moving towards, how do you help some of the entrepreneurs? A lot of the people here, they don't have equity, they don't have assets, they don't have monies that they can put into business.
The Navajo Nation government created a $20 million fund to help small businesses get started, Gay says. The tribe also just got control of telecommunication right-of-ways. For President Begay, though, it's not about moving away from extractive industry. The government has its eye on owning and running oil and gas and mining operations instead of just leasing the land to corporations. He says that would mean way more tribal revenue.
You have to provide incentives for people to come home. They all want to come home. You know, this is their land. This is the land of their ancestors. And they feel a part of this whole Navajo Nation.
Jobs today, though, are still hard to come by. Unemployment numbers are difficult to pin down. Reports say the rate is around 21%, but other tribal officials say it's double that or more.
There's threats to the jobs held by coal miners and employees that work for the power plants in this area.
Jessica Stego is the lead business counselor at the Native American Business Incubator Network.
While the extractive industries did provide jobs for our people, it didn't leave us with an economy that we could rely on.
She says the wave of jobs that flooded in 3 or 4 decades ago is receding.
So we're trying to figure out a way where we can build a local economy that is self-sustaining versus being dependent on these extractive industries, because those industries are dependent on the larger population and trends.
Stego's incubator helped the North Loop family farm get a grant from the USDA to work on selling their traditional blue corn in other areas. It's all about keeping local dollars flowing between local people, she says, and supporting the resourcefulness and ingenuity of folks who live on the Navajo Nation. I'm Marissa DeMarco.
The annual Mexican Día de los Muertos, Day of the Dead celebrations, are next week. In San Antonio, an exhibit at the Institute of Texan Cultures honors those who have passed on. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan explains.
David Zamora Casas cuts a striking figure. stylishly dressed, a Salvador Dali mustache and purple lipstick. His passion for detail shows also in his Time Before Memory exhibit.
The installation I've created comes from my Rascuachismo aesthetic.
Rascuachismo is the cultural sensibility of the poor and excluded.
The perspective of the underdog.
The exhibit stretches throughout the first floor and is divided into three large parts.
The formal Grand Altares of Mexico, the home domestic altar, and the Camposanto, the cemetery altars.
These altars, altares or ofrendas, are erected to remember the important people in our lives, a tradition seen most notably in Dia de los Muertos.
These 2 days in particular. November 1st is the day set aside to honor the deceased infants and children. November 2nd is for everyone else.
Altares vary from region to region, and while marigolds are the most common flower to see in them, Casas puts on his own spin.
I've incorporated blue bonnets because it's Texas.
Just as Mexican culture reflects indigenous spirituality mixed with Christianity, so do Casas altares.
Yes, it does include the Aztec goddess Cuatlicue. It also includes San Antonio and Jesus and the Virgin of Guadalupe.
The displays are 15 and 20 foot long apiece, full of pictures of people taken in their prime. Just as visitors stare at them, they seem almost to stare back.
As long as we say their name, as long as we keep them in our hearts, as long as we celebrate their life, they are alive.
You can see Time Before Memory till November 5th. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast, and Michelle Dubac is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.